You're listening to KNKX. The recent shootings in Seattle's CHOP, or Capitol Hill Organized Protest Zone, are prompting a lot of questions about public safety. Two shootings over the weekend left one man dead and two others injured, and another person was shot in the neighborhood on Tuesday. Attorney and activist Nikita Oliver says people should not use the shootings to discount protesters' demands. She points out that violence had been a problem in Capitol Hill even when the East Precinct was fully staffed.
And part of the reason we are mobilizing and asking for the defunding of police as a movement and asking for an investment in community-based public health and public safety strategies as a movement is because we know that the police don't keep us safe, that oftentimes police are called to respond reactionarily to violence that has already occurred. Policing is not a preventative method to stop violence. And what we want to see is an investment in the public health and public safety strategies that protect Black lives and protect Black bodies.
Oliver is not a leader in CHOP, but she co-directs an arts-based alternative to incarceration for young people in King County. And she's been a key player in Seattle's movement to overhaul police, courts, and prisons. Oliver talked with KNKX Morning Edition host Kirsten Kendrick about what it means to defund the police.
That particular demand is also attached to a demand for an investment in community-based public health and public safety strategies. It is the acknowledgement that it's not enough to defund the police, but that we also have to be investing in the grassroots strategies, the built by impacted community strategies that we know actually keep people safe.
Can you go into a little bit more detail about what the grassroots efforts are?
Yeah, this is kind of a two-part question. You know, the first part is about how do we actually move the budget effectively into the hands of community that has that knowledge. And so some of the things that organizers have been exploring are participatory budgeting. How can our city actually involve residents more deeply in the way that we decide, how we decide money is dispersed? And then, you know, finding those grassroots organizations that have already started developing those public health and public safety strategies and also developing the additional ones. Some examples are groups like Community Passageways, which has been doing incredible work on the south side of Seattle, partnering with young people in our communities who are experiencing violence or who maybe have been a part of causing harm. There are programs like Corner Greeters or Safe Passageways, which are both about creating, in many ways, autonomous safe zones. Corner Greeters focuses on building relationship between business owners and community members so that instead of calling the police, they're able to find ways to work together. And Safe Passageways is a program that focuses on how do we de-escalate situations on the street in the moment that they're happening. By having a visible presence, by building relationship, but also by providing access to resources. You know, in addition to that, we've also seen some very interesting things grow out of the protest. One example is a bike brigade that is actively helping marches, rallies, protesters safely move through the streets by shutting off roadways, by providing information about accidents or safety issues that we might be seeing. And they are now developing a structure for what could this look like beyond this phase of protest as a part of creating public safety on the roads or in partnership with organizers.
Is there a feeling that you can build on the momentum that is there now and have more of those conversations and really seeing what you want to see happen with the social issues being addressed?
Absolutely. The period of time that we're in right now has a convergence of issues that I think is bringing a lot of new folks to a conscious understanding of the ills of racialized capitalism, white supremacy, and how those relate to police, courts, and prisons. COVID exacerbated these pre-existing conditions, these pre-existing ills in our society, which I think for communities that maybe traditionally do not personally feel the impact of economic and racial injustice, they are now also in a position where they're economically suffering. And, you know, we've seen this in history in 1968 with the Poor People's Campaign, the Poor People's Movement, when we saw sanitation workers in Memphis. We saw them advocating for their rights as workers. We saw the labor movement growing. And simultaneously, the racial justice movement was also rapidly growing. And the convergence of these two movements brought both white poor folks and poor Black folks and also, you know, Black folks that maybe who had a little bit of access to income, all into the streets, all into the movement at the same time. I think we are seeing a similar convergence right now because of the way that COVID has exacerbated our economic system. People are developing a new understanding of what work needs to get done for us to actually get to a place of justice. You know, in Minneapolis, they're not simply talking about defunding the police. They're actually talking about disbanding their police department and are going to take the next year to figure out how that is possible. And so more people are coming to a rapid understanding that policing as an institution is actually rooted in white supremacy. It's rooted in the former enslavement of Black peoples. It's rooted in protecting property over people and planet. And as folks arise to that understanding, I do think more people will not only get into the streets, but find ways that they can be involved legislatively in their workplaces or in their educational institutions.
One thing we've been hearing from city officials during the protests is that leaders are working with the community. Do you think that's happening in a meaningful way right now?
You know, that's a great question. And I really think it depends on who you are and what your positionality is in our community. There are certainly some nonprofits that I think the city has had extended relationship with that, you know, they do have open communication with and have been at the table prior to this present uprising. But there are a lot of organizations that represent some of the most marginalized and most disenfranchised in our communities that are not at that table. And in many ways, they are the organizations that are bringing to the table the most radical, and by radical, I mean getting to the root issue, solutions of how we address not just police brutality, but the overarching system of the criminal punishment system and how it's rooted in white supremacy, and bringing to the table some solutions that get to the root of that. What I think is happening, though, that is significant, is we are seeing organizations that are at the table making more effort to reach out to organizations and organizers that are not at the table, and making more of an issue about that, which is opening the door for a broader breadth of Black community to be seated at the table. And it is an acknowledgement that Black folks are, we're not a monolith, and we don't all see things the same way. And there has to be space for more open, authentic, transparent dialogue if we're really going to get to solutions that meet the need of those most marginalized Black folks in our community, like Black trans women or Black folks who are formerly incarcerated. And so while I think the institution is having a hard time figuring out how to navigate this, I do think organizers and organizations within Black community are actively trying to find ways to unify, because it is an acknowledgement that this time right now presents an opportunity that we have not seen in a long time.